Hello, everyone. This is Bob Sadum. My amateur radio call sign is N1, BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH geographic location is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. I'll be reading for you in digest form today here on the Courage Handy Hymn System, the October 2008 issue of World Radio. World Radio is published by Armand Noble. Armand's call is N6WR. The editor, Nancy Kott, spelled K-O-T-T. Her call, WZ8C. Address information for World Radio Incorporated is 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. You can call them at areas 916-457-3655. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hymn System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hymn members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hymns may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. And we always spell Handy Ham, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. So, again, handyham@courage.org. Website is www.andyham.org. Let's begin with just a little bit of newsfront material. World Radio Newsfront, of course. Amateur radio news courtesy of the ARRL letter and newsline. Amateur radio vanity call sign fee increase. The FCC announced on 11 August 2008 that the cost of an amateur radio vanity call sign increased 60 cents from $11.70 to $12.30. The fee will increase 30 days after notice of the increase is published in the Federal Register. No date has yet been set for publication. The FCC is authorized by the Communications Act of 1934 as amended to collect vanity call sign fees to cover the costs associated with that program. The vanity call sign regulatory fee is payable not only when applying for a new vanity call sign, but also upon renewing a vanity call sign for a new 10-year term. The vanity call sign fee has fluctuated over the 12 years of the current program, from a low of $11.70 to a high of $50. That's quite a swing, isn't it? The FCC said it anticipates some 15,000 amateur radio vanity call sign payment units or applications during fiscal year 2009 collecting, here comes the big part, collecting for the FCC $184,734 in fees from the program. The vanity call sign regulatory fee is payable not only when applying for a new vanity call sign, but also upon renewing a vanity call sign for a new term. The first vanity call sign licensees issued under the current amateur radio vanity call sign program that began in 1966 came up for renewal 2 years ago. Those holding personalized call signs issued prior to 1996 are exempt from having to pay the vanity call sign regulatory fee at renewal, as Congress did not authorize the FCC to collect regulatory fees until 1993. Such heritage vanity call sign holders do not appear as vanity licensees in the FCC amateur radio database. That's an interesting thought at the end, isn't it? If you read the fine print, you get away cheap if you've been in it a long time. Next piece of newsfront, Pacificon in California. Pacificon will take place 17 through 19 October 2008 at the San Ramon Marriott Hotel in San Ramon, California. Sponsored by the American Radio Relay League's Pacific Division and the Mount Diablo Amateur Radio Club, Pacificon is the premier ham radio show for Northern California and neighboring states. This year's banquet speaker is Dr. Jill Tarter, the director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. More information about the convention and the banquet is online at www.pacificcon.org. Another piece, the Shale Island De-Expedition. Information has surfaced that the rare Desheho Island will be activated this fall. The dates being mentioned are 12 through 26 November 2008. The DX newsletter, in its edition 1585, says that the call sign for the operation will be K5D, Kilo 5 Delta. The newsletter adds that further details will be published shortly before K5D comes on the air. Here's a little bit about Hurricane Dolly. When Hurricane Dolly slammed into the Texas coastline on Wednesday morning, the 23rd of July, 2008, hams involved in the VOIP Hurricane Watch Net were already on the air. Dolly had become a Class 2 hurricane, packing winds exceeding 100 miles an hour. The storm caused heavy damage to low-lying areas on the border of the United States and Mexico, ripping off roofs and leaving thousands of people without power or telephone service. Cellular service was also reportedly overwhelmed. However, hams involved in Sky Warn and Hurricane Watch activities stood their ground. Radio WX4NHC, the amateur radio station at the National Hurricane Center in Miami, had already activated its high-frequency network and its Echolink and IRLP station at 1800 UTC on Tuesday, 22 July. According to Lloyd Colston, KC5FM, the VOIP Hurricane Net was called on 14.325 megahertz. On Tuesday evening, by Rob Macedo, call KD1CY, Net Operations Manager. WX4NHC at the National Hurricane Center monitored the net for field reports both by radio and by VOIP. Dolly was the second hurricane of the Atlantic season. It dropped close to a foot of rain in the first few hours after coming ashore. Hardest hit was the area south of Port Isabel on the border town of Brownsville. After making landfall, it weakened to a tropical storm on Thursday, 24 July, but concern remained over flooding along the heavily populated Rio Grande Valley. That was furnished by way of AR Newsline. Now to QCWA election results. Bob Rusk and Zero UI will be the next president of the Quarter Century Wireless Association, succeeding John B. Johnston, W3BE, in that post. Rusk, that's spelled R-O-S-K-E, a longtime QCWA board member from Hutchinson, Minnesota, beat out Len Nathanson, called W8RC, by a close vote of 1,037 to 991. Elected as QCWA Vice President is Ken Olke, Victor Echo 3 Alpha Fox Oscar of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Walt Supina, N3WS of State College, Pennsylvania, was selected as Secretary. And Frank Harris, WA4PAM from Clewiston, Florida, as Treasurer. 12 directors were also elected or reelected as well. And that was furnished by the QCWA and AR Newsline. Now, folks, this is Bob, N1BLF. As an aside, I just received yesterday from the QCWA the fall journal issue, which I'll be reading in several days back onto the Courage Handy Ham system. So those of you who are on the list of those to receive recordings can expect to get the process material sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks, if all goes well for us. Always fun to try to keep up with all the different newspapers and magazines in our wonderful hobby of ham radio, isn't it now? I have one more bit of news I want to put here near the beginning of the recording. It's headed Stolen Scout Radio Badge Collection. Jochen Sulowski, DK8ZM, is a keen collector of Scout radio badges and had possibly the largest collection anywhere until they were recently stolen. There were approximately 300 rare badges. Anyone who collects radio ephemera will understand the upset this caused. If you hear of any unusual or large numbers of JOTA or radio scouting badges appearing, then please do let him know. Or you can contact me. I'll give the gentleman's information in a moment. And I'll pass the message on. Jochens, that spells J-O-C-H-E-N, apostrophe S, Jochens, email is J, period, S-U-L-O-V-S-K-Y, at gmx.de. And the gentleman that's sending us in for him is, has it uppercase here, M0XDF, Mike 0 X-ray Delta Foxtrot, at Alphadene, that's spelled Alphadene, .co.uk. I'll give you that again. M0XDF at Alphadene.co.uk. Joachim is not looking to catch a thief. He would just like the collection back. There are pictures of the individual badges at http://www.radio-scouting.de/badges/. That was sent in by a gentleman named David Farrington. And, of course, I apologize, folks, for you listening. When I try to get something very specific and quite important to certain people out, I have to really sort of slow down the audio pronunciation. So do bear with me on that. I think we're all trying to help someone along the way the best we can. Well, it's time to give the editor's log a shot. Usually I give Nancy Cott the first shot out of all the reading, but today I went to the news items first. So this is the editor's log. Being the editor of an amateur radio publication has its advantages and disadvantages. On the plus side, it provides a unique opportunity to experience our amateur service from many more perspectives than I would see from my shack. Amateur radio captured my heart after the first QSO, and I have immersed myself in it for the last 20 years. So I feel very fortunate indeed to be in such a position. On the downside, it can get depressing to hear the bickering between the license classes or the modes. Sometimes I wonder if the amateur service will survive at all. By having editorial space like this one, I try to start some dialogue between the opposing points of view. I have tried to explain to the newcomers why some old-timers might be resentful and tried to get the disgruntled old-timers to see that the newcomers are the future of ham radio, and we need to Elmer them, not alienate them. Occasionally, people are so angry that they do not take the time to read what was written. They just skim over it or pick out a few sentences which they take out of context and go off on a rant and miss my point entirely. Maybe that is my fault for not being clear. I don't know. However, amateur radio has been evolving since its inception, but it seems the more it changes, the more it stays the same. If you get an opportunity to look through some old QSD magazines, please do. I was flipping through some from the 1930s and was stunned at how the hams of that era complained about one another, moaning about their inconsiderate operating practices, and calling people lids. It could have been a cut-and-paste from today's internet chat group or email reflector. Even more interesting was the lack of political correctness when the editor wrote back a retort to a comment. The one thing that has changed is the need for instant gratification. In the old magazines, there was a lot of talk about practicing code while off the air to perfect their fists. Amateurs took great pride in the way their code was formed. They would never dream of practicing on the air where they could be heard while they were still fumbling around learning the alphabet. That is one thing I wish more people would do. Take pride in your fist, don't get on the air until you are competent enough to send at least 5 words per minute, and you want to improve your speed. I've heard people on the air who obviously do not even know all the letters of the alphabet yet and are unreadable because they run all their characters together. Record yourself sending some text from a magazine. If you cannot send the text without looking up the letter or cannot copy it when you play it back, you are not ready to get on the air. You need to put in some more off-air practice time. There is no disgrace in practice, and it will pay off, trust me. Anyway, I digress. Amateurs have had the same complaints about each other since the inception of radio, and we are not going to change it. It is just built into our nature. Even if amateurs have not changed, the times have. There is a lot more competition for the attention of bright potential hams. We all need to make an effort to nurture and encourage the new people because we need to keep amateur radio going. Amateur radio is a family. Sure, we all have our quirks and differences. We disagree and argue amongst ourselves. But deep down, we have a common bond, and we need each other. If we don't support each other, who will? Thank you very much for caring enough to take the time to let us know how you feel. Please keep in touch either through our web page, www.wr6wr.com, or you can email me directly to Nancy, N-A-N-C-Y, at TIR.com, or via the editor at WR6WR. Even postal mail will still get to me directly. To Nancy, call WZHC, P.O. Box 807, Hadley, Michigan, MI, 48440. Well, we have the first piece here. It's titled, A Visitor's Guide to 160 Meters. The author is Devere D. Logan. Call W1HEO. If you're like most hams, the HF bands from 80 to 10 meters are familiar territory. But 160 meters? That's very different. Those who have explored this band down under find it necessary to make major adjustments in their approach to station design and operating. We found this to be true 2 years ago. Our DX activities had slowed with the decline of the sunspot cycle, so we became intrigued with the one band we had never used, 160. My transceiver included top band, but considering the space needed for an efficient antenna made me swallow hard and almost give up the idea. But not quite. Consider that a half wave at 1.8 megahertz is about 257 feet long. A horizontal dipole that size would probably extend well beyond the edges of an average city lot. This was my situation, so I went to Plan B. How about going vertical or using a shorter trapped type? A compromise appeared to be a quarter-wave skyhook such as an inverted L. Bingo! That was the answer. There were some tall trees in the backyard that would allow about 40 feet of vertical height, and another 60 feet to the back of my lot for the horizontal flat top. I had to cheat a bit by bending the end of the top leg to fit the total run of 133 feet, but it worked. A large variable capacitor at the base feed point helped with the matching. A 2-to-1 ballon is another option. Several radials were added to boost efficiency. The more, the merrier. My first discovery while checking out the band was the noise level. It was much higher than on the other HF bands. While my inverted L worked well on transmit, in receive mode, it was picking up lots of local electrical interference and atmospheric static. I quickly realized what veteran top banders know. A separate, quieter receive antenna was needed. I opted for a simple solution. Using 450 feet of insulated wire, I ran it around the edges of my lot through tree limbs about 7 feet high. It was connected to my transceiver through an antenna tuner and into the receiver antenna port. If your rig lacks that feature, an outboard TR relay would be needed. Hooray! The level of noise dropped amazingly. Weak signals that were copied very well on the random wire receiving antenna disappeared into the noise when switching to the inverted L. This demonstrated how very different propagation is on 160 meters. The amount of atmospheric absorption is much higher, so arriving signals are weaker. Another factor is that the amount of refraction or bending of signals doesn't allow them to get very high in the atmosphere. So, transmitted signals suffer from shorter hops with more loss. For the DX is used to hearing booming signals on 20 meters, this poses a challenge. Creativity in the antenna department is needed on top band. For local contacts, almost any transmitting antenna will do the job. Trapped dipoles, slopers, shortened verticals, etc., can fill the bill. For DXers, however, receiving options are affected by real estate. If you have a few acres to play with, the beverage antenna that is two or more wavelengths long and mounted near the ground lets you hear very well. Otherwise, choices would include compact loops, phased verticals, or a random wire. Now, what about the equipment for 160? While your current HF transceiver is probably fine for casual reg chewing on top band, serious DXing will call for some additional equipment. Since I'm a DXer, I asked a number of top operators what they use to improve their odds of working the much weaker DX stations. Keys Nijdam, the PA0CLN, modified a TS-480 with a separate receive input. Tony Buscaglia, K2NV, used an outboard MFJ-1026 noise-canceling signal enhancer. Many DXers add noise filters, bandpass filters, or preamplifiers to deal with noise and weak signals. Rigs with DSP, along with various IF shift and filter options, do help also. On the transmit side of things, since signals are attenuated by atmospheric absorption, amplifiers are standard equipment in most shacks. You need an amplifier, says Paul Dunphy, VE1DX. He went on to say you might work the odd thing with 100 watts, but 1.8 megahertz cries for QRO operation. This does not mean you need a $5,000 to $7,000 amp, but you should be able to put out 800 to 1200 watts. Most hams that I surveyed recognized that it is sensible to make the most of what you have on top band. The call there again, PA0CLN, said that although he lived on a small lot of 33 by 140 feet in the Netherlands, he managed to get up an inverted L with some radials. My tower was situated in the backyard, and the L did run over the house to a tree in the front yard. Good way to look at it. Now, regarding operating techniques, for local contacts, operating is similar to other bands except for the noise factor. Old-timers point out that many years ago, 160 meters was the equivalent of today's 2-meter band. Then, as now, there was lots of casual rag chewing at round tables. Good manners and respect for other operators appear to be more evident on this band than some others. This is especially noticed when a station is trying to work a weak DX station by repeating their call slowly while others stand by. For those interested in working distant stations or DX, band conditions often demand different operating techniques. Noise and static must be endured. QSB and fading are common. DX signals appear and disappear very quickly. A comment from Rich Bungierno states, I truly believe that persistence is the first quality a good top band DXer has to practice. Rich Coyle is W6VX. He continues, this band is one that requires being at the right place at the right time and staying with the DX as long as it takes. The majority of DX contacts on 160 are made using Morse code. Compared to single sideband, it has a narrower bandwidth and better signal-to-noise ratio. While not a high-speed CW operator, it's the mode I use for chasing DX on the top band. Tom Manning, called WD5T, agrees, pointing out that all but one of my countries on 160 meters were made using CW. With the current solar cycle at low ebb, perhaps now is a good time to explore 160 meters. Put up a wire and check it out. It's different and challenging, but it's what makes it fun. Well, folks, as I turn the page, I'm now at page 10 of the World Radio for October 2008, and lo and behold, I see an article by the publisher, Armand Noble, called N6WR. It's not about him. He's writing it in a tribute that's well-deserved to Mr. Screwdriver, who celebrated his 90th birthday. And there's a rather large picture of Don Johnson, called W6AAQ, reading the many happy birthday cards. It goes as this. On the first moment that the FCC allowed mobile operation on 75 meters, Don Johnson, W6AAQ, was there. It was 0001 Pacific time, 15 July 1948, and he'd been there ever since, collecting many friends along the way. 60 years and 2 weeks later, Dee and his XYL, Litha, W6HMD, threw a 90th birthday luncheon for a gathering of Northern California area amateur radio operators. Noted mostly for inventing the screwdriver, HF mobile antenna, he also shared his many decades of accumulated knowledge in the books. For instance, a title, 40 Years of HF Mobileering, another book titled, 40 Plus 5 Years of HF Mobileering, and another, Everything You Forgot to Ask About HF Mobileering. The last two were published by World Radio Books. Prior to working for some major electronics companies, Don spent 31 years in the United States Navy, including being in the thick of things in the World War II South Pacific in a noted PBY squadron. At the luncheon, he told of how a group of hams in the Navy played the major role in the search for an aircraft that crashed and the crew being rescued after 8 days. His 75-meter net frequency is 3905, which is also the last number of his Esparto, California telephone number. Many say one of the great attractions of amateur radio is the camaraderie. All the conversations at this festive luncheon prove that such is quite true. The master of ceremonies for the event was Dean Coates. His call, NR6A. Thanks a lot, Armin, for giving a good celebration. Hello from the community of amateur radio, from the Courage Andy Hemp Systems, and all the thousands of people who can hear us throughout the world on the Internet. We're going to go to DX World now. You know, folks, as you listen to these readings of World Radio, QSD, and also now CQ Magazine, which I've been privileged to read for all of you for quite a few years, you hear a lot about the sunspot cycle, or what there is of it, being virtually nothing. But still in all, it's going to get better. It says here in small print. So here's an article, Open Logs, comma, DXCC, and you. The author is Kelly Jones, November 0, Victor Delta, N0VD. The ARRL recently made an interesting change by removing the longstanding policy around publication of logs. In the 25 July 2008 issue of the ARRL letter, it stated that the board voted to eliminate Rule 5 from the Section 3 of the DXCC rules. Now, you guessed it. The rule says The presentation in any public form of logs or other representations of station operations showing details of station activity or other information from which all essential QSO elements, time, date, band, mode, and call sign, for individual contacts can be derived creates a question as to the integrity of the claimed QSOs with that station during the period encompassed by the log. Wow. Don't laugh. Presentation of such information in any public forum by the station operator, operators, or associated parties is not allowed and may be considered sufficient reason to deny AOLL award credit for contacts with any station for which such presentations have been made. Persistent violation of this provision may result in disqualification from the DXCC program. Whew, that's the end of that. Now back to Kelly Jones. I've always had mixed feelings about this rule. In some ways, I don't really care if complete logs are published or made available for inspection. However, I've always felt that having all of the information could lessen the value of the DXCC program. To explain this, let me illustrate an example that occurred recently. We all know and love online logs. During the Juliet 5 Charlie, J5C, the expedition, I was certain that I had valid QSOs on 20 meters and 30 meters CW. So sure, in fact, that I waited a few days to see if they would show in their online log. However, when later QSOs began showing while my two missing contacts were not listed, I became suspicious that the DX might have logged my call incorrectly. On a whim, I checked November 0 Victor Brava, and sure enough, N0VB had exactly two QSOs, the two that I was missing. Remember, Kelly Jones' call is N0 Victor Delta. Now, one could argue that the QSOs I thought I had were not valid since my call was logged wrong. Perhaps, but that's a topic for another day. If the DXPedition is using online logs as the J5C DXPedition was, this scenario isn't so bad from my perspective since I could simply go back and work them again. However, in the event the logs are only published after the DXpedition, there is no way of knowing my call was busted until after the fact. Let's take this a step further. Let's assume for a moment that N0VB was a dishonest person. I don't know N0VB, so this is purely hypothetical. But suppose N0VB was looking to increase his DXCC counts or band countries. With complete logs published, including the date and time, he could quite easily claim he made the QSOs, when in fact it was a case of incorrect logging by the DX. Now, it's a matter of trying to work it out with the QSL manager in order for me to get those QSOs confirmed. If N0VB says he indeed worked the DX at those exact times, I'm basically out of luck until the next time. Another problem with Rule 5 from Section 3 is that within the last couple of years, some of the major contest sponsors have begun publishing the full logs of entrants on the Internet. Here we have a case of a third party disclosing log information that is beyond the operator's control. I will admit that I am a sometimes contester, that was in quotations, and enjoy working the guys who go to rare places during the contest. In fact, getting on the air during the major contest is a guaranteed way to bump up your DXCC totals in a hurry. However, the stipulation in the current rule stating that publishing the entire log may be considered sufficient reason to deny AOLL award credit for contacts could have put an end to contesting. Whether the contesters realize it or not, a large majority of the QSOs they make are DXs looking to increase their entity count for a given award. These little pistols are not looking to win the contest. Instead, they simply want a QSL card. Now, if the ARRL were to have followed through and voided all fully published contest QSOs for any award credit, the little guys who come out of the woodwork on Sunday afternoon would simply disappear. To put it bluntly, there would be nothing in it for the little guys. In the end, I think the board made the right decision to drop this rule. Their rationale was that, and we're quoting, "The committee realizes that while publishing log data can have a detrimental effect on operating wards, it was not possible to control such actions, and the rule cannot be enforced. As part of an effort to maintain the integrity of operating award programs, the board called on staff to create resources and guidelines for QSLing and for QSL managers. These guidelines will help people who QSL to understand the, quoting, best practices and help to support the work of the QSL manager so that access to log data won't degrade amateur radio's long tradition of the honor system," end of quote. While having the entire QSO data published in the public domain arguably jeopardizes the integrity of the various award programs, leaving the rule as originally written could have caused unintended side effects. What's your opinion? Let me know. And that's from Kelly Jones. Call November 0 Victor Delta and 0 VD. Not the other ending subsect there. The author concludes his piece in this month's World Radio by stating, "If you have any DX information you would like announced, please send the information at least 2 months in advance to the following email address." His call, N0VD at DXCentral, DXCentral.com. You know, ladies and gentlemen, the Iraqi war has been going on for quite a while now. We all attest to that. Even if you go back to Desert Storm, it's almost shuddering to think about it. And myself, I've often wondered how the ham radio operators were doing that got sent over there in the hundreds and thousands among the troops. So there's an article here in this month's issue of World Radio. It's in the category of Morse code. It's titled Adventures in Hamming, Iraqi Style. The author is Will Dix, D-I-X. Will's call is KF4IZE, Kilo Fox 4, India Zulu Echo. I want to give the gentleman some time because I think he well deserves it. Let's read the article. "The installation of a ham station in the sands of Iraq in the midst of a major war is impossible, you might think." Impossible? No way. I've learned a long time ago that if there's a will, there's definitely a way. Although my primary concern was the safety and welfare of my soldiers in a combat environment, I was very excited at the idea of getting on the air as a Yankee India 9. That's a prefix YI-9. And finally, being on the opposite end of a DX pilot. It has been an incredible journey as an amateur radio operator. I was introduced to amateur radio as a radio operator in the Army. I can honestly say that had it not been for the Army, I probably wouldn't be writing this article today. I've met a lot of good people and made many friends in the last 12 years that I've been operating. Morse code has just made it all the better. It is, in my opinion, the true essence that makes this hobby great. As a soldier, the hobby has made my job in the Army Signal Corps easier to understand. I am proud to serve this great nation. Never will I take it for granted. During the spring-summer of 2004, my unit received orders to deploy to Iraq in support of the global war on terrorism. The training and preparation that followed was rigorous and arduous at best. Quality time spent with family and friends was of the utmost importance. But in the midst of all the preparation for the upcoming deployment, I thought to myself how neat it would be to take along an HF radio and conduct my own little de-expedition. About 3 months prior to shipping off to the sandbox, I contacted the ARRL to get a point of contact in order to obtain a YI call sign. The procedure was rather simple, and within 2 months of my request, I received an Iraqi license, which was good for 5 years, with a call sign Yankee India 9, India Zulu Echo. To my surprise, I was able to retain my stateside suffix. I've always thought that the IZE made it an easy suffix for sending code. On November 30th of 2004, with my Yaesu FD-857 Delta and J-38 straight key in hand, I shipped off across the Great Big Pond, destination Iraq. 17 hours later, we landed in the Republic of Kuwait for a 2-week training period before we would cross the berm into Iraq. During these 2 weeks, we were taught basic vehicle convoy procedures, advanced marksmanship, and attempted to stay somewhat physically fit in the vastness of sand. I didn't take along a power supply due to the lack of space, but I would take out my FD-857D from time to time and simply gloomed at it, just thinking of the moment when I'd be able to transmit CW and start making some contacts. Finally, the time came to take to the streets, and after conducting the 3-day convoy into Iraq, we settled down at Logistics Support Area Anaconda, as this would be our home for the next 12 months. I had packed away plenty of wire, coax, and even brought along my trusty SWR power meter. All I needed now was a power source for the radio. After some inquiring, I acquired 2 heavy-duty mil-spec 12-volt batteries from the motor sergeant and then threw up a homebrew 20-meter dipole. I was in business. It was on 25 December, Christmas Day, 2004, that I sent some long-awaited RF energy out into the ionosphere, and the floodgates opened. Once I transmitted CQ, this is YI9IZE, over. The next thing I heard can be described as a blur of stations hoping to get the chance at working Iraq. Although I operated both CW and single sideband, it was the CW mode that I found to be most relaxing and enjoyable. Most of my contacts took place to the west across Europe and to the east into Asia and India. My most interesting contact was with fellow FISTS member ALF, G3UAA. His number for FIST is 5519 on 26 April 2005. I usually found downtime, if you want to call it that, in the early to late afternoon hours after I made all my rounds to different communication sites that I was in charge of. I had operated 4 different radios during the course of my first deployment in Iraq, consisting of the FD-857D, an FD-101ZD, an FD-817ND, and the venerable Drake TR-3. I must admit, I do tend to favor the older vintage gear. Believe it or not, the latter 3 made the trip to Iraq from stateside in good fashion. The ham station was definitely a conversation starter and wowed many visitors to the site. As for antennas, my intent was to configure 20 and 17-meter flat-top dipoles that would radiate broadside east and west to the good old U.S. of A. My efforts paid off as I was fortunate to have made several stateside contacts. It was indeed exciting to be on the opposite end of a DX pileup. Well, it is clear to see that in between all the roadside bombs and incoming mortar rounds that I have encountered, there was still time to enjoy my favorite pastime. As a soldier, I want to say a special thank you to all who support the military and, of course, to the FISCS CW Club and its efforts. Remember, freedom isn't free, but you can always find some free time to send CW. Again, the author is Will Dix, D-I-X, call KF4, I, ZE, Kilo Fox 4, India Zulu Echo. I thank him very much. I hope you've enjoyed your reading. The article does come along with a picture of Will and several Kurdish soldiers in the Iraqi army near Kirkuk, Iraq, and also a long view of one of the highest mountains near Al-Solomaniyah in northern Iraq. You know, I really wish that he had signed it with some kind of an address, or most especially an email address. There's none here, I must tell you, because I would love to send him this recording of World Radio in MP3 format, which is the way I send it to the Courage Handyham system, and he could have it in a minute. Simple as that. But it's not simple if you don't have a key to the door, huh? Anybody out there that has Will's email address, let me know. This is Bob. My email is n1blf@comcast.net. Thanks a lot, Will. Hope you get home safely if you haven't already been here. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as we move along in the reading of World Radio, October 2008, I come across 1010 International's little section. And although I'll not read the entire part, I'm definitely going to give tribute here in time to an announcement. 1010 Director becomes a silent key. Steve Rasmussen, call N0WY. Steve's 1010 number is, or was, 68684. 1010 International Director, past 1010 News Editor, and CUSO Party Manager passed away on 30 July 2008. Steve had been in and out of the hospital since early January, after it was learned that he had an aggressive form of leukemia. Steve came home in early July and attended the Pioneer Amateur Raider Club's Handfest in North Bend, Nebraska on 12 July. I was fortunate at that time to be able to present Steve with the 2008 1010 President's Award for Outstanding Service to 1010 International. And the I was present is actually the author of the 1010 piece, Gerald F. Gross. Call WA6POZ. Change of pace now for Hamfest's announcements. There are quite a few here. I'll give them to you very quickly. So if you're interested in going to Hamfest, you hear the state and the location. Just listen up a little harder, that's all. Beginning alphabetically, Arizona. Old Pueblo Radio Club, with the assistance of the Radio Society of Tucson, its annual swap meet to be held on October the 18th at the Keno Sports Park, Tucson, Arizona. State of Connecticut, Meriden Amateur Radio Club, Nutmeg Hamfest, and Connecticut State ARRL Convention, also October 12th, 2008, rain or shine, at the Mountain Ridge Resort, Wallingford, Connecticut. The sunny state of Florida, and that's if there's not a hurricane going over. Platinum Coastal Amateur Radio Society Hamfest in Florida State ARRL Convention, being held 11th and 12th of October in Melbourne, Florida. In Indiana, Lake County Amateur Radio Club, that's October 11th as well, at the Lake County Fairgrounds in Crown Point, Indiana. Great State of Iowa, Muscatine Amateur Radio Club and Washington Area Amateur Radio Club, Southeast Iowa Hamfest. Now, that one's on October the 5th, so you better hurry. You may just about get this if you're lucky by October the 5th. Hi, hi. State of Michigan, Holland Amateur Radio Club, Great Lakeshore Super Swap. That's on the 18th of October at West Ottawa High School, South Campus, Holland, Michigan. Montana, Gallatin Ham Radio Club. That's going to be on the 11th of October at the Sachikawea Middle School. I hope I pronounced her name. My wife just loves Sachikawea. I've been hearing this for 55 years. But anyway, that's their Gallatin Ham Radio Club Hamfest, and that's going to be in Bozeman, Montana, on the 11th as well. New Jersey. I was born in Jersey. Bergen Amateur Radio Association, That's, now you're not going to make this one probably. October the 4th at Westwood Regional Junior High, Senior High, High School in Township of Washington, New Jersey. And the next door neighbor, the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club, is in New York Hall of Science parking lot, Flushing Meadows Corona Park. I don't think they're playing tennis there that week. And that's going to be a quickie too for you, October the 5th, North Carolina. Marysville Club Hempfest on the 12th of October at the Community Center, Maysville, not Marysville, Maysville, North Carolina. Pennsylvania R.F. Hill Amateur Radio Club, 19 October. You got a good shot at that one if you want to go to Sellersville Firehouse on Main Street in Sellersville, P.A. Lovely country. Texas, Paris, Texas Radio Group is going to be the 10th and 11th of October. They're so big down there. At least they are. They were until about 2 weeks ago, I guess, that they take 2 days to do it at the Coliseum and Red River Valley Fairgrounds in Paris, Texas, minus the Eiffel Tower, of course. And we conclude with the great and wonderful green state of Washington, North Kitsap Amateur Radio Group, Hempfest Swap Meet, 11th of October, at the President's Hall, Kitsap County Fairgrounds, northwest corner of Fairgrounds Road at Nelson Road in Bremerton, Washington. I think I'll wind up with the following. Army Mars, charged with convention role. This is from the text of Chief Army Mars, Stu Carter's biweekly broadcast to members, 23 August 2008. It goes, I find it hard to imagine a more challenging security operation than the upcoming Democratic and Republican national conventions. These climactic events, the first in Denver next week and the other a week later in Minneapolis, which is really was in St. Paul, I believe, will gather hundreds of America's top leaders who will be exposed continuously to milling crowds of thousands. Just the thought of protecting all the converging aircraft and congested terminals is daunting enough for public safety planners. That's what came to my mind when our operations chief, Grant Hayes, Whiskey Bravo 6 Oscar Tango Sierra, Slant Alpha 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 9 Oscar, passed along a request from the Transportation Security Administration for Army Mars support during the next 2 weeks. Mike Barrett, K3MMB slant AAA9TS is the Army Mars liaison with TSA headquarters just outside Washington. He's a career IT specialist, the last 28 years in federal service and a TSA staffer from that agency's beginning. He joined Army Mars in 2004. When Katrina struck, a year later, it was Mike Barrett who initiated the first TSA slant Mars emergency contact with Texas Army Mars. This week, he has been coordinating support requirements directly with Region 8 of the Democratic Party Convention beginning Monday in Denver and Region 5 for the Republican Convention on 01 September in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Here's the overall picture. The TSA's own Mars slant wind link teams are deploying from Tucson and Dallas to operate Alpha Alpha November 8, Delta November Charlie, with local staffers in Denver. Pensacola and Washington teams will deploy to Minneapolis as Alpha Alpha November 5, Romeo November Charlie. TSA's Barrett asks that our Region 8 and 5 make Army Mars resources available to the two convention operations as needed. He and his staff are already in direct contact with the regional leadership on details. For the information of members elsewhere in the country, Barrett messaged, quoting, "We feel that these events will provide valuable lessons learned and excellent training opportunities for the entire Tri-Mars force. We therefore request that all other regions stand by for possible support. We suggest regional slant X nets be authorized. DSH slant TSA will activate all Mars stations within its network in support and for training. Our resources will have direct contact with Department of Justice and FEMA resources, giving the Mars program an opportunity to further enhance the inter-op capabilities of all agencies. I've just said, this security operation is an awesome challenge. For Mars, it's an awesome opportunity. With just about 4 minutes left to go, folks, there's also an article by the Mars People. It's actually authored by Bill Sexton, N1IN, slant, alpha, 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 9, Papa Charlie. Within this article, there is the Stafford Act. Emergency military deployment within the United States was authorized under the 1988 Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, named for a former Vermont governor, congressman, and senator. Specifically, quoting, "All requests for a declaration by the president that an emergency exists shall be made by the governor of the affected state. Such a request shall be based on the finding that the disaster is of such severity and magnitude that effective response is beyond the capabilities of the state and the affected local governments, and that federal assistance is necessary." Close quote. But as amended, the law adds that the president need not await a governor's formal request if, and we quote, "an emergency exists for which the primary responsibility for response rests with the United States." Close quote. In that case, the president shall consult the governor of any affected state, if practicable, italics added. The Defense Department may be directed to perform any emergency work determined to be essential for the preservation of life and property. Another section authorizes federal establishment of temporary communications systems. Army Mars is the Mars branch designated by the Defense Department as primary for civil support, but works with Air and Navy Marine Corps members on operations. Well, folks, I think I'm going to wind it up right about now. My voice is about ready to die before I do, I think. I hope you've been able to bear with it. We've been reading in digest form World Radio Magazine for October 2008. The publisher, Armand Noble, call N6WR, the editor, Nancy Cott, WZHC. And the World Radio Incorporated headquarters is 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. You can dial them if you want at the area 916-457-3655. My name is Bob Zeta. I spell that last one Z-E-I-D-A. My call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My location, QTH, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, in southeastern Massachusetts, right near New Bedford, the great fishing port of America, Buzzards Bay, and sort of the gateway to good old Cape Cod and the islands of the Vineyards and Nantucket. Been a pleasure reading for you again today, and just remember that this is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hems may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. And remember, we always spell Handy Ham, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, handyham@courage.org. Great website at www.handyham.org. Thanks again. Hope to talk to you again next month, 7388.